Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Lob Podcast, presented by These Football Times. I am your host today, John Townsend, senior writer for the site. With me today, I have the editor-in-chief and creator and founder of These Football Times, Mr. Omar Salim. Omar, how are you doing?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I also have another senior writer who is featured on many of these podcasts, Mr. Andrew Flint. How are you doing, Andrew?
Not bad, John. Good to be here.
Excellent. And with us today, we have Matt Whitehouse, football coach and writer. How are you doing, Matt?
Yeah, I'm doing really well. Thank you.
And last but not least, we have Stephen Scragg. How are you doing?
I'm fine, John. Thank you very much. You okay?
I'm well. So today, I wanted to give us a chance to process England's exit from Euro 2016 and give us some time to talk about the state of English football, maybe the current state and the future state, and maybe the fallout. So I'm going to start from a coaching angle, and Omar, I'll start with you. What do you think about the coaching quality in the English game? We've seen a lot of reports that there's not enough UEFA A and B licensed coaches in comparison to Spain and Germany in particular. What is your assessment on the state of English coaching from the grassroots all the way to maybe the academy level? Can you kind of wrap it up? And Matt, I'd like you to jump in right after as a coach yourself and kind of give an assessment, piggyback off Omar's opinion.
I think per capita we're struggling in terms of the number of highly qualified coaches. So going up to the UEFA licenses, one of the great challenges that we've got is the cost of the license over here. If you look at the price, and I don't know the exact prices, but I think in Iceland the UEFA B license is about 50% cheaper, and that's why per capita they've got, I think, 50 or 60% more coaches, UEFA B qualified coaches, than we do. So that's certainly a difficulty over here. I actually done my UEFA licenses out in Ireland. One, because it was cheaper, and two, because it was easier to get on the course. I didn't have to wait as long. This is going back to 2009, though. So that's certainly a challenge. I think the quality of coaching is okay at the academy level. I think what we lack in terms of the national team, and I think we're producing players that are good enough at a club level to come through and succeed in the Premier League, but I don't know if we're working well to produce players capable of moving into the national team and succeeding for England. Now that requires a completely different type of player, a player that's able to perform in tournament football, which isn't the same as performing in the Premier League. I don't think that we instill values and respect for a foreign league, so say La Liga, Bundesliga, Serie A, when they're coming up through the system. And as a result, players then tend to be a little bit weary of moving abroad later on in their careers. In terms of the quality of coaching at academies, it's hit and miss. I've been to a lot of academies, and Matt will jump in afterwards, and John, I know you've been as well. At some academies, it seems like everything is very well planned, very well structured. I know Matt is doing that where he's at. It's very well structured. There's a certain plan in place to change the long-term aims of the academy. So from before, whereas it may have been produced, I don't know, you bring in a couple of players a year to the first team. Now it's more about the development of the individual players themselves, working as a unit, later on going, hopefully, as a group, capable of coming up to the first team and maybe recouping some money for the club in the long term. I'm satisfied that the standard of coaching in Premier League, League One, Championship and League Two academies is fine. And I think you can see that in the quality of player coming through. Dele Alli is a good example as well. He came through a lower league academy and is capable within 12 months of playing at the Euros. I think our problem, and this is a problem that is endemic throughout English football, is that we don't know how to produce players that are mentally capable of playing in a tournament. And that's, for me, was why we struggled with, why the younger players, say, struggled in the Euros. I think technically players are being coached at a better level. I think we're working to train players to be more technically astute than they ever have been before. But again, I don't necessarily always buy into the argument that our players were never that good technically. Stephen will speak for it. People like Glenn Hoddle, Chris Waddle, there were times in the 80s when our team technically was as good as anyone in Europe. That's not been the issue for me. And that is for me, so that's why looking at the Euro issue, it's not so much that I think that the academies are to blame for why we didn't do well in the Euros. I think that it's the mentality of the English player. I think it's the mentality of what we're trying to coach into the English player. And it's because these players aren't moving abroad. So they're not experienced in playing against different styles of football.
And Matt, what do you think?
Well, there's a lot to discuss there. Let me just touch on the youth side first, because I do think there's a big difference between what's happening in the youth development and what's happening with the senior team. Obviously, at grassroots level, I still don't think there's enough qualified coaches. Effectively, it's volunteer dads, which I don't think is of the quality necessary to help the pool of talent at the lower levels develop broadly. So obviously, a lot of players who go into academies will obviously kind of be, I don't know to use the word too much, but saved from maybe poor coaching. However, when they get to the academies, that can be hit and miss. I do think there's a younger generation of coaches coming through who appreciate maybe the more modern version of the coaching and development, put more onus maybe on skill development and not so much on the play simple kind of mentality or two touch only thoughts. But I still feel that the word technical has been focused on too much in the last decade, which has maybe taken away from the development of actually players' intelligence. We always look at the Spanish and think, wow, they're so intelligent. They know their movement, their decision making. They seem to not have a knowledge about what each of them are doing, and that's from their development. I do think we focus so much on the technical side. Like Omar says, our players aren't technically good enough. That's been what's been said. So, let's focus on that. And I think we just neglected other areas that actually have made us suffer a bit. That being said, though, our English teams and look at what Man City are doing right now with their academy. They're dominating at youth level. You know, they are winning tournaments. They're going at under 16s, 17s, 18s, 19s, and going to win tournaments across Europe. So maybe there's a few foreign lads that have come from abroad in there as well. But the English team particularly, though, is doing well. So then it gets to a point where you think, so what's the problem? When they get to senior level, why are the other nations now actually looking better than us? And that's where it comes down to the lack of opportunity for the older players. So I think actually we've got some really good players, you know, between 9 to 16, really good talented lads. And then they kind of get lost in limbo then of, you know, playing into maybe a development league or an under 21s league or youth team football. They don't play first team football enough, which is again the Dele Alli kind of example of a player who got thrown in at League One. He played 80 games for MK Dons, and the guy really just understood football. You know, he plays like a player who understands it. I know he didn't play particularly well in this Euros, but we marvel at Dele Alli, and that's because not enough players have been given that same opportunity to actually progress. And then that's why I think other players from other countries get the opportunities, play for maybe, you know, look at the Belgians, they come through their league because it is a lower league in terms of finances and status. They get more opportunities to play. So they actually accelerate their development kind of in the key years. So now when you look at them at senior level, you think, wow, where have they come from? And that is a big issue for us because the Premier League and the Championship is so strong financially, and obviously the rewards are so big to get into the Premier League that teams really can't risk using youth, which is a real shame because our players do get just left in a little bit of this limbo of their development and they really stunt it. But I do think we've actually got some good players, maybe not great ones, you know, at 14, 15, 16s. I don't think we're still producing enough of a real world-class young talent, but definitely ones with potential to be very good players. But we're getting it's been stalled between that 17 to 21s age group, and find a solution to that. It isn't easy, but what they do need to do is play more games, and that is a key area that we need to find a solution for, because our players don't look, for me, suited to play at the top, at senior level, good enough. And again, if you look at how many players actually playing Champions League who are English, I mean, I think, what was it, 17 was it last year, compared to about 85 Spanish, which I think that says it all, really, because we don't have enough English players playing at the top level of the game. That's because they're not good enough, because they haven't been given the opportunities to develop into Champions League players. It can't just happen overnight. It takes a lot of years to develop your skills, and unfortunately we've got a real big block in that kind of youth to senior gap, which isn't still being dealt with well enough.
So Stephen, Omar touched on something in particular that I want you to kind of tackle, which is comparing what you see in English football today versus these previous generations and size of English players. And, you know, you see talents in midfield like, you know, Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, Paul Scholes, you know, world-class talent. But what have you noticed in terms of the type of player in English football today versus maybe 10, 15, even 20, 25 years ago?
Yeah, there's a detachment from what they are now to what they are and were 20, 25 years ago. I think there's a less of a leaning towards letting natural talent blossom. There's more structure to it. It's almost like players are coached out of exuberance and natural talent. It's very much, you know, a chess game now, far more than it was 20, 25 years ago. There was more of a freedom allowed to players, you know, 2 decades ago than there is now. And I think that shows. You were talking about Italy earlier, and Italy are another example of that, is that the striking thing about Italy is that they're a team, and there's been no lead individual. There was always a lead individual with Italian teams of the past, and that you know, wasn't the case this time around. And England kind of mirrors that, but it's that taking away of innocence. It's that taking away of freedom, basically. That's the detachment I see between now and 20 years ago.
And Andrew, from your perspective, from afar, as an Englishman abroad, you know, what is your take on English football, especially from the, you know, watching the game versus Russia, where you're living now, and you being so close to Russian football, you know, what takeaways do you find that, you know, permeate Russian football and their development as opposed or in comparison to English football?
Well, the Russian football has so many issues. It would take an entire year to discuss them all. But one of the main ones is development of youth. And when I say development of youth, I mean not just as football players, but as, you know, as people, the way they are educated, the way they aspire to what they see around them. I mean, John, I've seen you talk about in the past on social media, you know, the idea of pickup games, you know, that joy of playing. You know, Stephen, you mentioned the innocence of young players, and you know, I look around here, and I've not once seen a purely spontaneous pickup game of football. Now, I mean, it may not be the biggest deal to some people, but I see a correlation between that and the attitude of Russian players in this tournament in particular. There's just a lack of motivation, a lack of energy. I mean, the academy system in Russia has gone under such monumental changes in the last 20, 30 years, from the Soviet Union when it was all centralized and all the resources were piled into a few major sporting societies, the Spartak, the Dynamo sports societies, which had many clubs around the Soviet Union. Yeah. Then came the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Spartak Moscow were the only club that kept going simply because they were at the top of Russian football at the time. But then the whole attitude of youngsters today over here is, you know, they look at players like Alexander Kokorin. He was touted as one of the brightest sparks of Russian football a few years ago. And he's earned a move to Zenit, where he's very comfortable, but he's got no motivation to move abroad. I mean, in England, we've seen Arshavin, we've seen Pavlyuchenko, we've seen Dinyar Bilyalyetdinov at Everton, who most people have probably forgotten by now, to be honest. But that lack of ambition to move abroad is a common thing I see between many English players and Russian players. You know, sure, language might be a part of it, but it's something that goes much deeper and broader than just simply coaching, in my view, in Russia at least. It's the attitude of youngsters, full stop. You know, there's no spark, there's no game intelligence at a youth level and going up into senior level. So that's what I see the main problem being over here.
So Omar, I want you to kind of touch on something, and Matt, I'd like you to piggyback off this again. I want you both to describe in your own way the British football experience in terms of the player's journey from when they start with the age of innocence, when they're playing in the garden, or they're playing pickup, or they're playing with their youth team, to when things start to shift and maybe they lose some of that. Omar, maybe you touch on your experience in academy football, and then, you know, Matt, as a coach, and, you know, I'm sure from our player yourself, can you kind of touch on that as well?
Well, I played at Fulham for 5 years. I joined the academy when I was 13. It was my local academy. the club was very different to what it is today and what it has been for the last sort of 5 or 6 years. My experience started off at the age of 4 or 5, playing in local organised little pickup games and stuff. So it was, you know, on the common, on Clapham Common, having goals up. And it's very different to what it is today. It was kick and run football, basically. And the coach wasn't giving any input and stuff, which is okay. I think the coach's aim was to get the kids to enjoy the sport, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. You want kids enjoying the sport. They need to develop a love for it. For me, most of my organised football in my early years came at school. I played in teams outside of school on Saturday and Sunday, but it was, again, it was the culture of the parent coach shouting from the sideline that, you know, you've got to shoot from 25 yards. I'm an 8-year-old, I can barely kick it 15 yards, but parents shouting, got to score, got to win, volunteer coaches dedicating their time, but without much expertise. In school, it was slightly different because we actually had a decent coach, and I'm glad for this because it helped me improve as a player. And I don't think a lot of young kids have experienced that in their lives. Perhaps, again, it's a little bit different today. And it was through playing for my school that I got scouted by Fulham when they sent scouts around. We got to the National Cup final. It was called the Heinz Ketchup Cup at the time. Played at Highbury and stuff. And a few of us got scouted after that. We were decent young players. But looking back now, the funny thing was there wasn't much of a difference between playing for my parent coach, playing for my school coach, and then going into the Fulham Academy. It was still very much the same thing, that you had to demonstrate a certain attitude, a certain will to win. If you weren't sure about the ball in possession, you were still good enough to play in the academy, you just had to get rid of it. It was about playing as quickly as you can forward. There was no, as Matt alluded to earlier, there was no game intelligence involved. It was about getting the ball as close as you can to the opponent's goal as fast as possible. And as a kid, you don't understand that. It doesn't matter to you. You're not thinking about the philosophy and what you need to do as a player to improve. Not at 13 anyway. So that was pretty much my journey up until the age of 18. I never made it based on the fact that I probably didn't have a good enough attitude. And I probably wasn't good enough either to go all the way to become a pro. I've played at a good level since then. I've played semi-pro for many years. I went to the US and played in some good teams over there. But my journey, and I wish I had been able to coach myself, is that with raw kids coming through my era, they weren't given the opportunity to learn the game of football. It was on the odd coach that wanted to teach us the right things about keeping the ball and being strong in possession and brave in possession and confident on the ball. The very few coaches that were capable of coaching that were well outnumbered by the guys that were basing their academy life as a coach on winning. Their whole idea of being a successful coach was based on winning. And that culture has permeated throughout English football, academy football. And Matt says he's right. Young coaches nowadays are changing that. But the one thing that I will always remember from my era is that as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, the most important thing for me was never development. It was winning. I would be hammered by my coach if we didn't win, if I'd made a mistake. Despite maybe having 89 minutes of really good football, intelligent football, I'd make one mistake and my confidence would be shot because my 11-year-old team didn't win. I think it's changing nowadays. Matt said it before. There is a generation of coaches today that are placing an emphasis on different things and are looking at coaches and not judging them after one or two training sessions or one or two games, but giving them a real opportunity to learn the game of football, both from a technical standpoint, which is what a good young coach will do, but also from tactical, understanding the game of football. It's not just what we see at the professional level. It changes from, you know, 11 to 14, 15 to 18, 18 and up. The whole game itself, the structure of football is very, very different. So that was my experience this coming up.
And Matt, go ahead and jump on that as well. I think, you know,
I think culture is a word that is obviously, I mean, if we look at English game, it's very different to how the Dutch developed in the last 50 years. And in a way, England, through people such as people, I don't know if you know, Charles Hughes, Alan Wade, kind of the FA guys, who weren't really football guys as such, but they actually used stats to kind of prove their philosophy about to score goals, you need to do it in less passes. And obviously that defined the kind of English way, which was get the ball forward as quick as possible, because if you do it in less than three passes, you'll score more goals, which, you know, actually isn't a wrong idea, because obviously that's a quick counter-attack. That's what they're trying to say, that you'll play quickly from maybe a turnover in possession in transition. However, they took it to an extreme of that's all you do. And English culture completely got affected by that. So pretty much anyone who was involved with English football in the last 50 years or maybe 35, 40 years, coaching, players, everyone's been involved with this culture of direct football, kind of up and at 'em football, very plain direct. And really, we've got left behind so much by other nations who took football to another level that we've always been behind. And we're still that now. You know, English football talks about it being one of the most dominant. You know, we're leading the way and things like that. We're not. We're so far behind where other nations are. And the problem as well now is the culture now of coaches coming in and saying, no, we want to be more like the Spanish. We want to be more like the Germans or the French or the South Americans. It's almost like there's a confusion about who actually we are and what our culture really is. The problem with that is you'll get some coaches who really want to have skillful players and I want you to express yourself. And then next time they'll go somewhere else and the coach will say, no, I don't want you to do any of that. I want you to play simple. So this joined up feel, again, and this happens in academies, it'll happen in other, you know, clubs. They move to another club, it might be a different place. And that happens, you know, first team football is similar. But my point is, what is English culture? What do we do? And I think that shows in the way England played in the Euros. You know, who are we? What is our identity? How do we play? Do we defend really strong and organised and compact? And that's proven to do very well. Even Portugal are playing like that. And they've got to the semi-final, Wales as well. Or do we play in an open, expansive possession game, which, while at times, while we kind of kept the ball quite well, it didn't really have any end product. There was a lack of quality in the final third, which is really where the quality of possession really shows. And we lacked that. We didn't play counter-attack football, which I think we're actually built for. So to be honest, the English DNA, the FA, they seem to want something that I don't think we've got players equipped for at this time. So they're on a development journey themselves. But it's very frustrating because already now everyone's saying, let's throw it all out and let's start again. And that's kind of been an English problem again and again and again. And the young players suffer for it because it's always like there's a new kind of thing that's come in. Oh, we're going to do this now. And then a few years later, oh, we're going to do this. And obviously the players are going through this development cycle where they're kind of being told contradicting things throughout their development. I do think the FA, in fairness to them, have put in some good things with the youth modules. And I do think that more coaches are more educated about how kids learn and what they need to have in their skill box at a young age. But to develop top players, I still think we're struggling because I don't know. I still think there's a big divide between maybe the younger coaches who want to play a bit more of a modern way and still the older coaches who tend to be with the youth teams, with the 21s, with the senior teams. They're the ones who take those kids from being youth players to seniors. And are they really taking them to another level, or are they just kind of making them more functional and then say, oh, well, they're not good enough? You know. So again, I do think there's a massive cultural issue within English football. I think there's a problem between coaching and maybe experience in regards to ages and a difference in ideas there. And I do think that's having a massive impact on the players that we've got.
And it's interesting you mentioned development cycle. And Stephen, I want you to talk about what you've seen in your years in following and being involved in English football. Sometimes we tend to think of this idea that Matt just hit on so eloquently, which is throw everything out and a generation will suffer for that, or tweak a bit and put someone in who maybe understands the game a little bit more than the previous manager, the previous person in charge. Do you think English football needs a visionary at the helm, at the senior team or in the FA, or do you need somebody who maybe provides a little bit more tried and tested stability? You know, and one of the things that I think has been rumored is maybe English football needs a really young coach, someone in who has fresh ideas, who is, you know, understands the young player because he's not that far removed. And, you know, what do you think from your perspective on this development cycle?
Yeah, I mean, there's all manner of directions they could take it. I mean, you can go for a younger coach who's more closer to the generation of the players that he's dealing with, or you can go. For me, age isn't the issue. It's just having the right person. You know, you can't. For me, you can't bracket, you know, a right and a wrong. There is no age differential. You know, Arsene Wenger and Roy Hodgson will be around about the same era of age, yet they are polar opposites, and that will go through every single generation. And And for me, it's just about having the right people in the right places. And it's not just a case of saying, you know, it's the England coach and that's the problem and you change it. I mean, when England failed to qualify for Euro 2008, for example, you know, this root and branch review was promised and things would change. But then the FA kind of like fluttered their eyelashes at Fabio Capello and gave him the job and a great deal of money to do it. And it, for me, it's got to be more than just an aesthetic change. There is, you know, it has to have the right people in the right positions across the board. And there's got to be a connection between the people who are interlinked, basically, from the boardroom to the executives to the coaches, to filter through his undercoaches all the way through to the players. That there has to be a chain of communication and understanding. And they're the type of things that I see missing. You know, I don't think there's much wrong with the players in this country. They are very good players. You know, yeah, maybe not world-class players, but you don't need world-class players in this era for me. You know, you look at Italy and that and how they have very good players who work together as a team. And they've managed to do that by embracing the basics and getting the basics right. And in England, we fail to do the basics at high levels of office in football, in politics. And there's a huge repercussion on the back of it. So yeah, the age difference isn't for me. You know, it's just that it's the right people, and the right people can be any age. It is just that concept of connection and understanding and moving as one, rather than everyone pulling in different directions. And that's where it comes from for me.
And Andrew, you know, from your perspective, coming from the background of a league that I presume has a sizable winter break, what does it mean that, you know, we talk about coaching issues, but talk about the league structure and league format and volume and frequency of intensity of match. Do you think England, the top level leagues, need a winter break? Is this something that, have you seen a difference in Russian football, a freshness that's come back into it? Do you think it's going to help English football to actually implement 6 weeks off in the winter, or is it too congested now? What are your thoughts on that from your perspective?
Well, the winter break is, I think, it's an interesting issue to explore for English football. I can't see how the full programme with the League Cup, FA Cup, you know, European football, Premier League, how it could still fit in with a winter break. So I think there has to be something that needs to be changed there. Perhaps, you know, the involvement of Premier League teams in the League Cup, perhaps. Over here, it's an enforced winter break, fairly obviously, because of the weather. So, you know, if we're talking from December until March, it's a 3-month winter break here. But what the Russian FA decided, which is one of the weirdest and stupidest decisions I've ever seen made by an organisational body, was about 4 or 5 years ago, they thought, well, to give our clubs in Europe a better chance, let's align our league system with European leagues. So the winter period is actually the mid-season break now in Russia, which is just absolutely mad, because you break up an entire season for 3 months like that. The clubs go away to summer training camps. They play sort of mid-season friendly tournaments against, you know, Cypriot second division teams. It's a complete waste of time. I'll give you an easy example. Look at Zenit St. Petersburg this season in the Champions League. They absolutely blitzed the group stages. They got some stunning players, many of whom have now left this summer in the last week or two. But they won the first 5 games in the group stage, did sixth one, didn't matter. Got to the knockout stages, and after 3 months without competitive football, it was they were knocked out with no problem. So Stephen, you mentioned the basics. I think the basics on all level, organisational, coaching, are just so, so important. The organisation of the league system around Christmas, everybody who supports the idea will say it's a tradition to have Boxing Day football and 4 or 5 fixtures over 2 or 3 weeks. I don't understand why. Why does it have to be a tradition? you know, not every tradition in the entire world has stayed the same forever. And I don't think people would complain if it just became slightly more manageable. I mean, would the players wouldn't complain. We know that for one. So, yeah, to answer your question, I think a winter break is certainly an option that should be investigated. It doesn't have to be a long break, just even just a guaranteed fortnight, something like that. I don't think it's the answer to freshness and fitness in major tournaments. That's 6 months down the line. That's another matter. But I think it's something that should be explored, definitely.
So you mentioned freshness versus fitness, and Omar, you and I talked about this offline and, you know, at length, you know, on social media a bit. But we both have our perspectives on this debate, which has reared its head on social media. Raymond Verheyen has been very, very vocal about, you know, why England failed or why they didn't succeed, as opposed to, you know, why other teams have. Do you buy into the idea that England wasn't fresh enough, that maybe they're not fit enough mentally or what have you? And can you kind of give your coaching perspective, maybe to his remarks, but also to the topic at hand in a larger context, maybe taking the 10,000-foot view instead of just getting into the nuance of it all?
Yeah, I don't buy it. I think the freshness, he talks about freshness and fitness. Listen, you can use whatever jargon you want. He ultimately is talking about a lack of performance, but which team at the Euros has looked particularly fresh? I don't think anyone has. I think the standard has been good at the tournament. I don't think it's been brilliant. It's why I've written before about the fact that the Champions League is a much better tournament, because the players are at their peak condition and they're all playing well. So I think the Euros, while it's been exciting, while we've had some good games, I don't think anyone has looked fresh. So it's not just an argument that England don't look fresh. That's nonsense. And I think it's a disrespect to a lot of the coaches within English setup that have tried to prepare the players as best they can. The other argument, and this is the fact, is that a lot of the teams that have gone to the latter stages of the Champions League and the Europa League have played more games than the English teams have, because a lot of the English teams weren't that successful in the cup competitions, or they were hit and miss. City were good in one, weren't good in another. Same with Liverpool. Liverpool were really, really good in the League Cup, really, really good in the Europa League. They weren't brilliant in the FA Cup. And besides, a lot of the Liverpool players haven't actually been starting for England in the tournament. And Raymond Verheyen has spoken about that on Twitter anyway. So I'm not sure I buy the argument with the freshness. I think that is more of a cop-out than anything else. The issue wasn't freshness. The issue was that England weren't set up to play good football in the tournament. I think that the issue was Roy's team selection was questionable, and I'm sure we'll get onto that in a bit. But to blame it solely, or to blame it largely on freshness, or whatever you want to call it, fitness, for me, it doesn't wash, because I just don't think anyone has looked particularly fresh. And the great example comes in the fact that a lot of the national team managers have taken the opportunity to rest their key men whenever they can. If they can take them off within the game, if they can give them a whole game off, they've taken it, because this is the end of a long season. And we've had this debate before. It's happened so many times before, both with regards to the winter break and saying that we need to have our players fresher. I don't see what 2 weeks will do for a tournament. I'm not sure what a two-week break will do for players going into a tournament in the summer. I'm not sold on a winter break personally for that reason. I think there's other reasons why we should, but if we're saying we need a winter break because our players will be fresher in the summer, I don't buy it. I don't think it makes a difference, because the Germany players, the players who have come from the Bundesliga, they don't look that fresh to me, and they have the longest break of all in Europe. So I don't personally buy the freshness and the fitness debate. And if we're saying that a winter break will have a big impact on a summer tournament for England, again, I don't see it. I don't think it works like that.
Matt, what do you think, you know, let's get back into the tournament itself. Where did you find England fell short when it came to performance? Was it coaching, or do you put more onus on the players on the field not managing the moment, not managing the match? What's your take on England's performance, especially, you know, looking at the Iceland game, but even the Slovakia game? You know, what did you see was the major falling point for the national team?
I mean, the thing is, we didn't win the first game. If you don't win the first game, confidence doesn't always help. Win the second game with a last-minute one, brilliant. Then you make changes in the third one. We don't win that. If we win the group, we would have obviously been on a high, and obviously our progression might have been different. There's a lot of excuses for England. I mean, effectively, we didn't take our chances very well. Was it a fitness thing? No. It was a. I think maybe you can make an excuse for a Harry Kane, perhaps, because he has been a very integral part of Spurs' season. Spurs' football, you know, was excellent throughout the season, and they did have a drop-off at the end, which was a confidence issue as well. And obviously, we saw that in the Chelsea game particularly, and obviously the final game against Newcastle. But for me, it was just a lack of organisation, a lack of getting the team right, a lack of knowing what the team was and how we were going to play. I mean, the key guys in the team, obviously the Spurs core, who I thought obviously earned to be kind of the lead figures in that, they play a different way than what Hodgson and what the FA want. And again, going to the FA DNA aspects, if we want to dominate possession, we want to play probably something similar to what a Spanish, German, Bayern Munich, Barcelona type of football. That's what you can see they want to do. I don't think we've got players who've been brought up in that. It's not something you can just say, oh, we're going to play like Barca today. You know, it takes a lot of time to develop the understanding of positional play and actually what that means, and also to turn possession into creating chances, which England aren't very good at. You can say that they're on the pathway to doing that. So if that's what they want to go, then it's going to take a long time to develop that, which will mean that we're going to have a lot more tournaments, for me, of disappointment. For me, Hodgson is a guy who is built for this 4-4-2 defend deep transition game, which really, if you looked across the game in the last few years, has become pretty much the blueprint for most teams outside of Barca and Bayern to build their success from. Obviously, the Germans used a 4-2-3-1, but at times 4-4-2 out of possession looked pretty much like that. It really has become a game of strong defending, organisation, and counter-attack. Leicester won the league based on that last year, and Simeone's been brilliant at Atletico. And I've seen that in this tournament as well, where Italy have defended very well. Obviously, Portugal have been a similar kind of outlay, going between 4-4-2 and 4-3-3 at times, but very organised, very compact, very defensively strong, and obviously looking for chances on the break. Wales have obviously embraced a 3-5-2 like Italy have as well. It's all very defensive, which just makes me smile with Hodgson, that this is a very defensive coach who for decades has been this type of coach, who now the modern game almost suits his skill set perfectly, and he's playing a football that is completely alien to him. But that's the fault of the FA, saying, look, Roy, you're an English guy, we respect you, we want a yes man kind of thing in here, you're pretty much the best man for that, so let's get you in, but we want to play this style of football. And in fairness, against the lesser teams during the qualification campaigns, we've looked good. But whenever we come up against better teams or in the big tournaments, we struggle and we suffer. And I do think sometimes that's a naivety from the coaching. Maybe Hodgson not willing to actually implement what he wanted and going towards what was asked of him, which I think was a major fallback. But also inexperience of our players as well. I mean, I'll give Hodgson credit for obviously having to transition the squad and the group of players we've got, because we went from a lot of experienced players from the last decade of the golden generation, we call it, who again failed on the big stage because the 4-4-2 they were playing for too often was too naive, too open, and teams exploited us too easily. And again, there were a few penalty shootouts, but that comes down to our mentality again. And I think there's going to be something we'll touch on later about England underperforming over decades of football. But to be honest, we're about where we are because of these flaws. But this group is hardly got any caps. I mean, if you look at some of the players like Kane, Ali, Walker, Rose, you know, these players really haven't played a lot of games for England. So we're expecting a lot from a very inexperienced group of players. So again, effectively, the expectations were too high on a young group. Problem is, English football hasn't been able to transition and evolve the squad to give these players a chance. But then you can argue that actually some of these players, if you put like a profile together 5 years ago of up-and-coming youngsters, these wouldn't be on the list. You know, because the problem is with English football, we look at players at 16, 17. Like I said earlier, look at Loftus-Cheek, for instance. A few years ago, this would be guy would be saying, look, he'll be playing for England at the Euros in 2016. But he's nowhere near, because he's not getting the opportunities, whereas all other players who maybe have come from lower league teams have actually gone above the pecking order. So it's very hard to kind of develop a long-term plan for England, because actually there's players who are coming through based on form more so than players who actually long-term seem to be part of the development plan. I think Germany have got that plan down a lot better, where they seem to have really been able to put just a one or two pieces in every tournament just to build it. But what Germany have done is, this is what England, I think, should have done and really copied them, really, is build from a defensive basis of counter-attack, which is what Germany did in 2010, and just gradually, in the next 6 to 10 years, start to develop into a possession game. You look at Germany now, they're the best team at the tournament by far. They're playing the best football. They're playing a very fluid football. It's very much possession-based, but obviously there's elements of counter-attack to it. In 2010, this was a very defensively strong counter-attack team, but over time they've evolved. It's the same coach, it's the same ideas, it's the similar players, And really, what they've had the plan perfectly. And I do think you should build from this defensive structure first off, and then start to develop the possession game. That's how I think it works best for a group of players, because I think if you get the defending side right, you do look more organised, you can be more successful, you can scrape through games. I think England have looked so naive out of possession, and I really do think Hodgson really messed up there, because that's been his forte, is getting teams organised and defensively strong. And for England, we've just looked completely out of sync in that sense. And unfortunately, we've suffered majorly. It's not about fitness. For me, it's confidence. If you're confident, you're fit. Kyle Walker for the first few games looked sharp as anything. So it's not about like, oh, they can't run. They're just not, they haven't got confidence, and they clearly lost confidence in Hodgson. That's an issue maybe for English players and their respect levels. You don't see Italian players having any issue with Conte, because he's such a leader. Has Hodgson got the respect of the players? Has he got enough of a credence? Has he got enough success in his career for players to go, yeah, I'll listen to this guy? Mourinho goes to Man U, and you know that the players are going to listen to him, no question. But then that comes again down to English coaches and think, well, when was the last time an English coach won anything? I'm pretty sure it's Harold Kendall in 1985. I might be wrong on that. But 1985 was the last time an English coach won a major trophy. That no one's ever won the Premier League, an English coach. No one's ever won the Champions League since it's come through. It's just incredible to think that English coaches really haven't been able to get anywhere near the top levels of football. So how are we going to be able to produce English managers for the English national team when we haven't got any ones who are actually successful? Now, again, you guys might disagree with that or not, but I do think there's a major problem with actually the culture of coaching in England and how it's respected from other cultures. The lack of languages is an issue. Coaches don't go abroad to learn new languages, because obviously, similar to players, I think they struggle to obviously embrace cultures, embrace different languages. And in effect, other managers across the world are just far ahead of us in a tactical sense, in a language sense, in a communication sense. I think English football in that sense is very still behind. So it's very much, there's a lot of issues there, but I don't think fitness was the problem, to be honest. I think there's a lot more to it than that.
John, can I jump in with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just quickly, I mean, I think Matt has hit the nail on the head there. I think the issue with British coaches, British players not going abroad is a massive thing. And I think that it's why we don't have that game intelligence, a lot of the players. I think that when you go abroad, you play against different styles of football. And I don't just mean if you go to Spain, it's one style, in Italy, it's one style. It's not. The teams within those countries are playing different styles of football, both at academy level and at the senior level. And you can see it with the English players in the past that have gone abroad. And we'll take Gareth Bale today. He's capable of playing a whole different number of styles, because at Real Madrid, they will sometimes play on the counter-attack. They will sometimes be the dominant team where they've got to play intricate football in tight spaces. You can see it with other players. When Paul Gascoigne went abroad with Lazio, he completely changed his style of football, and he became a little bit more Italianized in the way that he played. He was a little bit slower. He took the right option more often. Perhaps he wasn't brilliant on the counter-attack at times, but he learned to play different styles of football, which meant he learned how to break down different styles of football. And the Iceland game is the great example of it, that Roy should have known better as a manager because of the fact that he's been abroad. So he should know how to break down systems like that. He knows how to break down systems like that. I think he just got it wrong as the manager. He just made a poor call. But our players were unable to play against that system of a team sitting deep, because in the Premier League, you don't often get teams sitting deep with 10 men behind the ball and saying, come and attack us. The one time that it's happened to success was Mourinho doing it a few times at Chelsea the season before last, and we hammered him for it. We said that he's parking the bus, when actually it was very good management. He won the league. So it's the same with the coaches as well, not going abroad, not learning different styles. It's because we have this idea that we can be better. We have this belief that we are going to be better tomorrow, that tomorrow will be better today because we're going to do this. And it doesn't work, because you can go through history and it clearly hasn't worked for us. And because of that, our players are growing up and they're fearful.
Stephen, you've seen generations of English footballers and teams, and some with people going abroad. And I think recently people have slated Gary Neville for, you know, failing, you know, using air quotes at Valencia. But I think that there's a bravery to that. There's a risk. And Matt hit it really well in the head with regards to taking that chance, learning a new culture, learning a new language, learning a new way of playing football. What have you seen in, you know, comparing the, you know, the Euro 96 team to the Euro 2016 team? You know, what is the major difference or the differentiator for you going back through generations of English football?
I said before that there was more of a freedom of expression that seemed to be embraced 20 years ago to what it is now. I mean, there's still flair, but it's almost like a choreographed flair nowadays. It's you know, set movements on the ball, and it's almost like it's drilled into them, and then it's performed on a pitch. Whereas it used to seem spontaneous, what they used to do. And my mind's eye, I can see a difference there. I mean, the difference between the England of 96 and 2016 aesthetically, which is separate to the style of play and how the players play, is that in 96, although a lot of people say they overachieved, they didn't really. There was a little bit of luck here and there, but you can't point to me any side that wins a major competition without a degree of luck and a game where they've not played particularly well. You know, Spain won the World Cup and they lost to Switzerland in their opening game. You know, people forget these things, and England tend to get hammered for the fact that, oh, well, Euro 96 didn't play very well against Switzerland, should have locked out against Spain. But what England had then at that particular tournament was a template. And Terry Van Bos came up with a particular template, and he picked the players to be able to carry that template out to work that plan to perfection or near perfection. You know, you look at some of the players that were around that didn't play. You know, you had one of the most natural goal scorers English football has ever produced in Robbie Fowler, and he only played a bit part. And whereas now and subsequent generations down the line has been a case of there are certain players that must play. You know, thou shalt not pick a team that doesn't play. The team that England took into Euro 2016 differed from the one that played in the warm-up games. Wayne Rooney, for instance, had to be accommodated within that team. And then suddenly it meant alterations were being done. And there's a degree of politics being played. And I don't know whether it's, you know, someone, a coach shouldn't be forced into it. And I can't see Roy Hodgson being a man that is being told who to pick. But, you know, there's pressure from the squad, from the players, from his captain in particular, or whatever it is. You know, I constantly see these instances with England at major tournaments, and there's been very few occasions when England have gone to a major tournament with a set plan and a template and a framework, and just to say, look, these are the players that need to go into those positions because they will carry out those particular jobs. You know, it's like the old argument about Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard couldn't play together. Maybe they shouldn't have played together. That brave decision of one of them not playing perhaps should have been made, and it wasn't. And there's a backing away from brave decisions, you know, a lot of the time for me. And generational mistakes continue to be made. I mean, as far as expectation goes, you know, England tend to go out of tournaments where they deserve to go out of tournaments. You know, they deserve to go out where they went this time. They deserve to go out to Iceland. Iceland with a better team. And there was that degree of, you know, disrespect to Iceland. I mean, but within that, football, it repeats itself. History constantly will repeat itself. For Iceland now, you're talking Norway 20 years ago, Turkey. You know, what used to be degreed as the whipping boys, they evolve and they learn and they improve. And, you know, the blind eye is turned. And as much as people say that the Spains and the Germans and the Italys get better, you know, the nations behind improve. You know, there's a degree of standing still. I've also seen kind of like a detachment in English football. It's almost like a law unto itself, at Premier League level at least. It's, you know, it's almost like a law unto itself. It is its own separate entity. You know, you can't equate it to everyone else, the way the game's played across the continent. But within that, strength can be found. You know, if you have the right people in the right positions and harness the strengths to a technical and a tactical plan, as coaches like Wenger has done, Arsene Wenger, Rafael Benitez, Jose Mourinho, then it can it can be delivered. And that's the difference for me. But you're talking about two different games from 20 years ago to now. And it is just an evolvement, basically. And England haven't evolved very well, certainly over the last decade of that.
Regards, you know, people from abroad tend to see, you know, does England need a, you know, an evolution or a revolution when it comes to their football? Andrew, what do you think of the pressure, the external pressure from the media and the expectation and in many regards, almost the expectation of underperforming? Has this been part of your upbringing supporting English football forever? And after Andrew's done, anyone feel free to jump in, because as an American, I don't really know this. I can only see from afar and make my judgments. But Andrew, go ahead and take that away.
Well, yeah, I think I think a lot of the brave decisions that we see other teams take, and I mean, talking about bravery on the pitch, taking players on, you know, being intelligent, being spontaneous, it just reminds me when I was at school. I remember seeing the first team playing. We had five teams in our sixth form, and the first team, every Tuesday and Friday, I think it was, they had two coaches from Manchester United's academy who came to coach them. So they had those two coaches. They had two FA qualified coaches. I don't know what level. So they had a coaching team of four for the first team. I played for the third team. I wasn't a great player. I wasn't a bad player. The third, fourth, and fifth team had one Latin teacher who didn't have a football qualification. And it, to me, it sums up what has kind of developed in the mentality, the, you know, the psychology of England as a young, you know, the youngsters coming through. They look at the flash glory, they look at the skills, they look at the YouTube clips, the social media, they want to, you know, they talk about the choreographed flair, Stephen. I completely agree with that. I think it's the players can do it, but it's just they can't do it without, you know, they need inspiration for it. And you look at the Germans, the Spanish, many other nationalities, they can do it without needing to be told how to do it. And this, you talk about the pressure, John, from the media. I think it's not just from the print media, the online media, but the pressure of the all-seeing eye of social media. I think that's come into it in the last few years. You know, everybody has seen every single tactical nuance analysed, every single flick and trick and skill. Everybody has seen everything. So there's no hiding from it. Everybody has to live up to everything else. And I think that's the pressure. I think the pressure, the real pressure, is, you know, youngsters put it on themselves almost. You know, they see things and they want to emulate others instead of develop themselves and their own intelligence. So the pressure from the English media is well known across the world. But I think I would extend that into pressure that youngsters put on themselves, the social media. I put a lot down to it.
Yeah, no, it seems like the world's definitely a smaller place now, and I think players cannot escape. That is the social media, the print media, and all that. Stephen, I know you've got to run. Where can people find your work, and what are you working on now currently in your writing?
I'm still plugging away with These Football Times, and I believe there's a new magazine coming out very soon. So at the minute I'm working on an article based on the 1978 World Cup and Mario Kempes and the dark shadow as well. So it's a darkness and light piece.
Oh, brilliant.
So that's coming up soon.
We'll be looking forward to seeing that. Matt, where can people find your work? And
So obviously I'm at the White House address, and so I try and get as many blogs out as I can, but obviously it's dependent on time. But I've got my two books out, The Way Forward, which is focusing on obviously youth development and coaching, and Universality, which is looking at the future game, which is touching about obviously modern trends in tactics and how it's evolved and where the game's going, really. And obviously I'm on Twitter at @_W_address, so feel free to come and find me there. And people tend to follow me then and follow me quite quickly, I guess, after they realise that I tend to be on Twitter quite a lot. But anyway, anyway, if you can persevere with me, then it's not too bad, I promise. But no, for me, obviously my full-time job's head of coaching at an academy in England, and I'm very much obviously committed to developing as a modern a program as possible there. So hopefully in the next few years, we start to see some real talent coming through there. So that's my main priority. But I do enjoy discussing tactics and talking about youth development with people on Twitter and writing blogs. And I think it's great. I think it's a really good kind of generation of people now, like yourselves at these Football Times, you know, putting some really great stuff out. And I think it's really good education for people looking to enhance their knowledge of football and coaching and everything like that. So it's a really good time, I think, with the social media in that sense. So yeah, it's a lot of positives.
Absolutely. And Andrew, what are you working on currently?
Well, I'm focusing on these Football Times great platform that Omar set up for us. Very grateful for it. I'm working on a book with another writer at these Football Times as well, with Matt Gold, on worldwide derbies. So hopefully that will be coming out at some point in the next few months. Those are my main projects at the moment.
Excellent. And Omar, you are busy as ever with the site and all the things that go on managing us crazy writers. So where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Omar Saleem. But just send me an email. I'm fathering more and more writers every day. So I'm always around for a chat about football.
Brilliant. Well, this has been an episode of the Lob Podcast by these Football Times. I want to thank Matt Whitehouse, Omar Saleem, Andrew Flint, and Stephen Scragg for joining us today, and thanks for listening.